/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
KBOO's fall membership drive starts on the 10th, and you could help make reaching our fundraising goal a little easier by offering a matching donation of at least $500 for us to use on air during the drive. Matching money is a really great motivator to entice our non-contributing listeners to donate, so please email membership@kboo.org if you would like to sign up or have any questions. Or just call 503-231-8032 and ask for the membership department to plan your fall drive matching gift today.
Well, good morning. This is KBOO. The show is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagrang, and hosting with me is Kurt Liebezeit, and our guest is Nicole Foss, who writes under the name of Stonely for the Automatic Earth, and she's on a world tour, and she is coming to Corvallis and Portland very, very soon. So, Nicole, are you there?
I am indeed.
Oh, welcome to KBOO. And Kurt, welcome. Why don't you start out?
Good morning. We should say welcome back to KBOO.
That's right.
Because we've interviewed you in the past. It's been a couple of years. And we're very interested in talking to you about, you know, how things have changed in your perception of what's going on in the world. But first, we should probably give a little bit of background on who you are. Would you like to do that, Nicole?
Yes. I'm an international speaker and a writer for the blog The Automatic Earth. We're big picture people, my writing partner and I, and we look at finance and energy and environment and population and carrying capacity, basically limits to growth across a whole range of different factors, how all those parts of the puzzle fit together. And then we try to give people the biggest possible big picture so that they can navigate their way through what will be a really quite challenging future. And I tend to focus on finance because it's the first challenge that we're actually going to hit up close and personal, and it's really not that far off.
Yeah, for a lot of people, it seems like it already has hit in many areas of the world. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. And there's some places that are in full economic depression already. Other places are teetering on the brink. But even in places where you haven't seen a shift into outright depression conditions yet, like in quite a lot of America, for instance, there's still an ongoing economic train wreck on Main Street. Things are getting so much harder for ordinary people, even as Wall Street booms and all the headlines are about optimism and recovery. Things are getting harder and harder for middle-class Americans.
There's this key feature that has been in your writings, which is that there's sort of a center of the empire, if I can use Pear's words there. And then there are the fringes of the empire. And it seems like all the action is, well, a lot of the really severe action is happening out in these fringe areas, and it's working its way in. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's essentially a hypothermia scenario. So when you start to find that there's not enough to go around, the center acts like a hypothermic body. It cuts off the circulation to the fingers and toes in order to preserve the body temperature of the core, or the financial health of the core in this scenario. So what we're seeing is less and less ending out at the fringes, and in fact the fringes are having an extractive role at the moment. So the center is not just not sending anything out to the fringes, it's actively sucking up what remains there in order to try and maintain itself. So if you look at the places in the world that are absolutely booming, it's smaller and smaller places all the time. So you're seeing housing bubbles in the poshest neighborhoods of the biggest, fanciest cities in the world, rather than an across-the-board rise in house prices, for instance. So you're getting huge bubbles being blown in places like London and Sydney, for instance, and Vancouver.
And Seattle.
Not, Yeah, but not places that that are more peripheral.
Well, does this have to do with some country? The oil is so expensive now that some countries or people are just priced out of the market. They're not able to afford the oil.
That's part of it, but that's by no means the main factor at the moment. The main factor at the moment is the credit squeeze. That people have been pushed so far into debt, and now their access to credit is being cut off, that they just do not have the purchasing power in their pockets that they did before. Plus, the cost of living has risen. I mean, in America, just looking at factors like healthcare and university tuition and things, all these major expenditure classes have been rising just relentlessly, and far more than the price of oil. So, yes, the price of oil is having an impact. It does push up the price of a whole range of goods, but that's not the driving factor at this point.
Well, tell us about these municipal bankruptcies.
Are you thinking of Detroit?
Detroit, yes.
And, well, also, we were talking briefly before the show began that there were two kind of key indicators that happened this year. You mentioned Cyprus and Detroit. And
maybe, Cyprus, right, yes.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about why Cyprus was such, what happened in Cyprus and why it was such an important signaling event.
Be prepared to see your bank account vanish the way it looks to me.
Yes, and that's something we've warned about many, many times before. What happened in Cyprus was they had an enormously over-leveraged banking system. It was 800% of the size of their whole economy because they were an offshore financial center. So when they got into trouble, as always happens when you have a disproportionate banking system, then basically the banks closed their doors and all the accounts above 100,000 euros were basically haircut enormously. It isn't exactly clear yet how much will be gone, but my guess will be probably all of it. Of course, the well-connected had enough notice to get their money out of the country beforehand, including the president, who removed 21 million euros of his family's money before the week before he closed the banks. Well-connected foreigners were able to withdraw their funds from London or from Moscow. But in Cyprus itself, banks were closed. A whole raft of Cypriot business lost all its working capital. And within 1 week, it became a cash-only economy. So the EU declined to bail out Cyprus because they didn't want to bail out basically the Russian money that was involved in Cyprus as an offshore financing center. So they said, no, if your banks collapse, you have to bail out the bank with the depositors' funds. So there was an enormous bail-in using the depositors' funds to deal with the banking crisis. And that really is an enormous problem. I mean, not only did they haircut the accounts above the guaranteed 100,000 euros, they threatened initially to haircut the smaller accounts as well, which, of course, destroys the value of a deposit guarantee because people see immediately that as soon as a deposit guarantee becomes inconvenient, it's not there anymore. So it's not really a guarantee. And Europe said fairly quickly after the Cyprus crisis that bank bail-ins will be the mechanism for dealing with banks that get into trouble in the whole European Union in the future. Now, they got into trouble for saying this, but nevertheless, they were being honest about that. There are a lot of places very much bigger than Cyprus that are on the verge of getting into the same kind of trouble. So now you have British politicians saying, get your money out of Spain while you still can, which is an obvious thing to do. So the credibility of the banking system in the European periphery has essentially been destroyed by what happened in Cyprus. And although Cyprus is very small, it sets an extremely important precedent. And shortly after the issue in Cyprus arose, became clear that Canada, the United States, all of Europe, and Australia and New Zealand either all have or are developing legislation that would provide for the exact same bank bail-in kind of mechanism. Now, your bank account balance is not considered to be your money. It's simply a liability that the bank owes to you. It's a promise they've made you that they may or may not keep, depending on their capacity to do so. When we have a systemic banking crisis, which I think is inevitable, as I've said for some years, then say goodbye to bank balances, and deposit guarantees won't be worth the paper they're written on. This is why Cyprus is so important. And I'd be more than happy to talk about Detroit following on from that, but I thought I'd give you a chance.
Well, a quick question. Is a credit union a little bit safer, or are they just in the same fix?
Not necessarily safer. I mean, they'll be dealing with the banking system as well. So it's not that that's removing funds from any contact with the main banking system. And they're still going to be invested in things like property and assets that are going to be revalued very, very much lower. So they're not particularly secure in the longer term either.
So maybe we should talk about Detroit, which is sort of the horrible example, the current horrible example.
In America.
Yes.
Well, yes. I mean, it's an extremely important turning point, I think. So part of the common thread is promises being broken. The common thread between Cyprus and Detroit and what's going on in Greece and many other parts of the world is promises being broken. Too many promises have been made. They cannot all be kept. In Detroit, bankruptcy is the final realization that they're going to have to break promises, not just by tweaking a few things here and there, but by comprehensively eliminating promises and moving on from, wipe the slate clean, more or less, and then move on from here. So if you look at Detroit, the pension funds are being asked to take a 90% haircut. So are the general obligation bondholders. And there will be basically something similar to possibly even 100% haircut on retiree health care benefits and things like that. Mind you, the owners of the derivatives contracts are only being asked to take a 25% haircut because derivatives contracts have super priority in bankruptcy. So when there's not enough to go around, they get first dibs on whatever there is. They have a higher priority than pensioners, bondholders, or the residents of the city in question. So Detroit had large losses because they had been missold, I would argue, interest rate swaps. That's simply a bet on the movement of interest rates. But the counterparty to this bet, the banking system, the financial institutions that sold those financial instruments, were in a position to actually fiddle the interest rate that the bet was based on, because it was based on the LIBOR rate, the London Interbank Offered Rate. And we saw this past year the scandal of fiddling the LIBOR rate. So they were able to sell financial instruments that would have super priority and then ensure or make it more likely that they would win the bet. When the interest rate fell instead of rose, that means it went against the city's position. So it's not a debt that they have, it's a liability because a bet they made went bad. And this is a bet that was not really an honest bet because of the people who sold it to them being in a position to influence the outcome. So the derivatives will get paid out almost entirely, but promises to everybody else are going to be broken. So this is going to have significant consequences.
I think there'll be a huge uproar, won't there?
Pensions are enormously underfunded anyway, even more so if you actually make realistic assumptions about the return on investment for those pensions, but that's a separate issue. But people are about to realize that pensions are not secure. They're only promises. And it's easy to make promises, and it's hard to keep them. You make them in the present, and then you're imposing that liability on ratepayers in the future. But we're reaching the point where it's obvious the ratepayers in present-day Detroit cannot meet the promises that were made. So pensions are just going to disappear in Detroit. And the problem with the bondholders, when they have to take a 90% haircut, this is going to raise the cost of capital, not just for Detroit, but for all municipalities. So municipal debt is going to be seen as extremely risky in comparison to the way it's been perceived now. It's always been seen as safe. The cost of capital for municipalities has been quite low. But when people finally process what's going to come out of the Detroit bankruptcy, the cost of capital for municipalities will go through the roof. Almost all of them borrow a significant fraction of what they spend every year. They spend far more than they take in tax revenues. They borrow the difference. When the cost of that borrowing goes through the roof, it's just going to push them over the edge. So if people paid attention to, say, the analyst Meredith Whitney some time ago, she's going to be right. So people think she was wrong because they thought she was making a specific prediction about municipal bankruptcy specifically in 2010 and 2011. She actually wasn't, if people listen to the famous interview she did. She was simply saying that municipalities are facing a brick wall and an awful lot of them are going to tip over the edge, just like Detroit has done. So Detroit is simply the leading edge. There will be many, many more. And so we're really going to see the value of promises cut to next to nothing. If the value of promises is only in existence as long as the promise is credible. As soon as the promises are not believable anymore, the value of those promises goes to nothing. And that's what we're going to see for pensions and bonds. So it's going to be an enormous adjustment. And this is really where the crunch will come in America. There's all the drama at the moment about the debt ceiling and the shutdown and Obamacare. Yeah. This is political brinkmanship and political theater.
Right.
This is not actually where the real action is going to come. The rubber hits the road at the state and the municipal level where they can't monetize debt and they can't print money. And an awful lot of them are about to hit a brick wall at 100 miles an hour, no matter what the feds do.
Oh, boy. Well, it looks like Detroit is the dying canary. This is Fight the Empire, and I'm here with Kurt Liebeside, and we are talking with Nicole Foss, who writes under the name Stonely at the Automatic Earth, and she will be coming to Corvallis in Portland very, very soon.
And perhaps we should just mention the times and dates of those talks.
Sure.
In Corvallis, it's on October 9th, which is a Wednesday night, and it begins at 7 p.m., and the venue is the First Congregational Church, which many people are familiar with because that's where the contra dances are held. We're actually going to be in the sanctuary of that building, and it's 4515 Southwest West Hills Road in Corvallis next Wednesday. And then on the following day, Thursday, Nicole will be speaking here in Portland at the Tabor Space Community Center, which is 5441 Southeast Belmont. It's right there on the corner of Southeast 54th and Belmont.
The 55th.
Well, yeah, 55th if you count the actual building, 54th if you count the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that also begins at 7 p.m. Both of these events are...
Now, that's downstairs in the dining room, is that right?
Yeah, that's downstairs mm-hmm. in the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these events are essentially free will donation. No one turned away at the door, so...
Well,
I should mention that mm-hmm. it won't just be me. I'm traveling with a co-presenter by the name of Lawrence Bomer, who works in community revitalization. So I'm going to be describing the big picture, and Lawrence is going to be looking at what people are doing about facing this kind of situation in various parts of the world.
I'd like to ask you one thing, and this sort of follows from what's happening in Detroit and other municipalities, is in the future, will people be able to retire at all, or do they keep working until they drop? How do you see that?
I don't think there's going to be any such thing as retirement in the future. Retirement is actually a reasonably new thing. It's really only been within the last 100 years, and initially retirement was about a very small amount of money for the very few years that one might be expected to live after retiring. Now retirement has come to mean 30 years of playing golf at the same standard of living that you had before, more or less,
mm-hmm.
for a reasonable percentage of retirees. But those days are simply over. We're going to be living, I think, in extended families again, where people are going to be looking after their older relatives, or the older relatives are going to be looking after the grandchildren while the working age population actually tries to find enough work to bring in money to support all of them. This has been the pattern throughout most of history, and it still is in most parts of the world. It's really only in places where there are state guarantees of some kind or some private system that allows people to retire that's no longer the case. So the nuclear family scenario is really not going to be viable at all under circumstances where benefits and entitlements of all kinds start to disappear, which I think they will comprehensively.
Well, that makes you think of my dad grew up on a family farm in Norway, and for a long time, his mother and dad, they ran the farm. They had a kind of a large house, and then when they got old enough, they moved to a little apartment at the end of the house, and then the next oldest son kind of took over the farm, and that was not my dad, so he became an accountant in this country eventually, but that's the way they did it back then, Maybe that's, if we have an agricultural future, maybe we'll be doing something similar.
Well, that really is the tried and tested pattern over thousands of years, really, that you have extended family units, because a nuclear family on their own, in the absence of benefits and entitlements, is not a viable unit. You really need extended families together as a village. That is a viable unit of human habitation under circumstances where people have to look after themselves a lot more than we are used to.
Yeah. You know, Nicole, that kind of leads into, I want to ask you about the preparation angle, because that was something that was present in your earliest talks, but it sounds as though now with Lawrence on board that it occupies a greater portion. And I wonder if you could kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of some of the preparation and community building type of things that go into your talk.
Well, I will be touching on things like local currencies and time banks and the slow money movement, and then Lawrence will go into more detail on the ways that people are coming together, not necessarily using much in the way of money, but to build social capital, simply coming up with community projects that bring people together so that they're used to working with each other, they trust each other, and when push comes to shove, their first instinct will be to come together and work out what needs to be done. Now, local currencies can make a very large difference, and time banks as well, when push comes to shove. That's what's happening all over Greece. You're getting community currencies that are springing up because there's very few euros in circulation in some of these places. So people are coming up with their own means to exchange value, their own measure of comparative value and means of exchange. And that's very much the sort of thing we'll need to be thinking about. And that's what they did in the Great Depression as well in various places. And it can be extremely successful, especially if it's supported by local government.
Yeah.
One of the things that Lawrence and I have been doing with our new material we've been developing is looking at local government and how that might be able to avoid some of the challenges that are coming and to try and reinvent itself in ways that are better able to serve a very different future.
I'm glad to hear you say that bit about local currencies because, you know, you'll be speaking in Corvallis, and Corvallis does have its own local currency called the Hour Exchange.
Mm.
And I've been trying to get them on board as a sponsor. I'm not successful yet, but I know that that's right up their alley, and they do an immense amount of community building type activities. In fact, this Saturday they have their fall festival down in Corvallis at the Westminster House pretty much all day.
Mm.
And that's where, you know, people come together, they barter, they exchange goods, they connect in a community way. And it sounds like that's kind of what you've been describing here.
Well, I know in Greece, when they had their crash, farmers started bringing their crops right into the towns directly to sort of sell them or trade them with people. And then a lot of townspeople, you know, they go back to visit their families who live in the country, and they'd take up gardening in a really severe way. And so it's like in some ways people are trying to solve this whole thing on their own.
That's exactly what they're doing. And if you look at Detroit, one of the most interesting things I find about Detroit is the number of people who've completely given up expecting government to do anything whatsoever for them and are trying to take matters into their own hands. And they're producing permaculture gardens on the vacant lots. And there are markets in town that have nothing to do with the municipality. All of this is completely grassroots initiatives.
Kind of guerrilla-like, right?
Oh, yes, and mm-hmm. It's very small at the moment. But nevertheless, I think there's really a lot to be said for people downloading responsibility and saying, you know, what can we do about this? Not expecting the cavalry to come and solve all their problems and hand out whatever it might be, but to say, what capacity do we have to make a difference? And, of course, if people come together in advance and think through in advance before push comes to shove what they might need to do, they can set up quite a lot of structures and mechanisms that will make life a whole lot easier when the crunch actually comes, because they'll have had a chance to plan and to put things into practice and work out the bugs before they have to rely on the results. So I think this is a very important way of thinking, and one of the things that we're trying to do, one of the primary goals of this tour, is to get people on that trajectory, taking those first steps before everything gets difficult, in order to be able to mitigate the impact of a crunch and help people to move through it in a much less painful way.
That's good to hear. Well, we're at the 24-minute mark here, and we have a couple more minutes. Are there special situations that you're keeping an eye on around the world right at the moment, just as they're developing? Besides Detroit?
Europe is really the focus at the moment. So I'm interested in what's happening more in the European core. So we know that the European periphery is, has, in various places, has already gone over the edge. In some places, they're in a kind of stasis with the loans everybody knows will never be repaid, still not marked to market. So there's a kind of limbo going on in places like Ireland. But I'm interested in places like France and Holland and Scandinavia. France is on the verge of tipping into crisis. In Holland, the property bubble is bursting. And in Holland and all of Scandinavia, there's an enormous amount of personal debt. There are huge housing bubbles. So these are places people don't associate with reckless finance or anything like that. And they tend to think these are the places that are very solid. They're actually not at all. And it'll be when the core starts to tip into crisis that people really realize the extent of the difficulties that Europe is facing. So I think the risk is that all of that could blow up in people's faces fairly abruptly in the not-too-distant future. But I still think the single currency has absolutely no future. And Europe is the leading edge. So when we start to see Europe tip more into crisis, I think very many other places might follow suit. And, of course, the United States, I think, is also poised to go over the edge at the state and municipal level, as I've said. And that comprehensive waking up to the fact that promises are not going to be kept, I think, is just going to cause mayhem at some point.
Well, maybe
people
should
rely on these promises, and they have no idea that these promises are going to be completely invalidated.
Well, if growth is slow or non-existent, then debts don't get paid, and if debts don't get paid, then
kaboom!
What happens?
mm-hmm. Exactly. So there's going to be a wave of debt default. Essentially, what we've had is this enormous expansion of excess claims to underlying real wealth. So there are far more claims out there, probably 100 times at least as many claims to anything real, as there is actually anything real to cover those claims with. And the implosion that I'm looking at, the financial implosion, is about people waking up to that realization, trying to grab for their share of underlying real wealth. But in the process, which will be messy, in the process, most of those excess claims will get eliminated. In other words, the promises that those claims represented will be broken. But there's an enormous amount of reliance on these promises, so it's going to be a tremendous period of upheaval. And it could play out reasonably quickly, like it did in Cyprus. In 1 week, it went back 50 years. In 1 week, it became a cash-only economy.
Yeah. Just to kind of connect, like when you say that there are excess claims, like a simple example of that might be someone's mortgage, correct? Because, you know, we think of that as a simple contract between a borrower and a bank, but then the bank goes off and sells it and somebody else sells that, right? Is that kind of the picture that goes on there?
Essentially, that there are, through the securitization process, that's been a major engine of credit expansion, an engine of the creation of excess claims. So fractional reserve banking is another one, the development of the shadow banking system, and the fact that all these assets that these loans are based on are enormously overpriced compared to what they'll be in the future. So if property prices fall a long way, and even in the States they have a lot further to fall, this blip is extremely temporary because of government guarantees, but we are going to see enormous fall in house prices again. That will put a whole lot more people underwater in terms of their mortgage. So their mortgage is a large claim on an asset that's then worth a lot less than the value of the mortgage. So that's one way that you get excess claims. Pensions are going to be another. There are promises made against productive capacity for the future, but that productive capacity won't be there to meet those promises, so those will also be excess claims.
Oh, my. Well, I think we're going to have to end this show now. Well, we've been talking with Nicole Foss, who will be appearing in Corvallis and Portland, and we're looking forward to seeing you when you show up here. And
although you have a long ways to go, you're in Arkansas right now, right?
That's right. Well,
yeah, so I'm driving to L.A. to pick up my co-presenter, and then we're coming north.
Okay.
The whole trip will be 20,000 kilometers, or I think that's about 13 or 14,000 miles.
Something like that. Well, happy motoring.
Right. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you very much. And thank
you're very welcome.
And thank you, Kurt.
No problem.
This has been Fight the Empire, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. It is a minute now before 10 o'clock. After Air Cascadia 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein speaks with author, journalist, and blogger Max Blumenthal about his latest book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews novelist Jonathan Lethem about his new novel, Dissident Gardens, which considers what happened to the real American Communist Party after its Depression-era heyday. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the topic is My Life in the Negro Leagues, the autobiography of Wilmer Fields. But first, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Thanks for listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio.
Tune in to Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland.